From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I am Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. On this edition of the program, Amy Webb, author, futurist, and founder of the Future Today Institute, and futurist Mark Pelatucci, joins me for our annual conversation about the future of technology and its implications for business, society, and politics. The Future Today Institute is a leading future forecasting firm now in its second decade. Founded by Amy Webb in 2006, the Future Today Institute focuses solely on how emerging technology and science will disrupt business, transform the workplace, and ignite geopolitical change. It uses data-driven research to model and prototype the future. Amy is the author of several books, including her latest, The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. The book warns of the role nine of the world's biggest tech companies are playing in the development of artificial intelligence and how it could affect all of humankind. Amy, can you please give us an overview of this past year's Emerging Trends report?
For the past decade and a half or so, have put together an annual report that compiles research and analysis on the most important emerging trends globally. And we intentionally look across different industry spectrum, but we do focus on technology. So the most recent report came out in March, and we're actually in the process of writing our next report right now. But in 2019, some of the key areas of influence had to do with the lack of privacy, the fading of traditional mobile phones and mobile devices. We started to see a shift into biotechnologies, biorecognition, you know, and a general uptick in how AI is proliferating all around the world.
Amy, I want to congratulate you on your recent book called The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Who are the Big Nine and what qualifies them for inclusion into the Big Nine?
In the research that we've been doing over the past many years, artificial intelligence has always emerged as a key element in the future. And that has to do with the fact that artificial intelligence is not a tech trend, but rather the third era of computing. And when it comes to artificial intelligence, there's a tremendous amount of misplaced optimism and fear. So in the process of doing the strategic management consulting that I and my colleagues do at the Future Today Institute, I noticed that over and over again, there were nine companies that kept coming up in our research and discussion. Six are in the United States, three are in China. The Chinese companies are collectively referred to as the BAT. Those are Alibaba, Baidu, and Tencent. And in the United States, I like to call them the G Mafia. That's Google, Amazon, Microsoft, IBM, Facebook, and Apple. And it's these companies that overwhelmingly control not just the data, but they have the lion's share of patents. They have extraordinarily high pools of talent from which they can pull new people. They've got established pipelines. And it's their custom frameworks that are used. It's their devices that are used. So it is these nine companies that are building the future. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they are doing things to intentionally hurt humanity, but rather that the motivations for both are different. So in China, these are technically Chinese companies, but because they're domiciled within China, although they may be public, they're still very much under the rule of the CCP. And in the United States, our six companies are publicly traded and have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, which means that oftentimes they have to prioritize speed over safety in rushing products to market. And this bifurcated track that artificial intelligence on and what that portends for our futures, the good, the bad, and the ugly, is the basis for the book.
Mark, I want to talk a little bit about AI. As Amy was mentioning, artificial intelligence, or AI, to most people, when they think of AI, they look at it as a future technology concept, something that will be put into use years in the future. But AI is really already here, and we're pretty much functioning within a framework influenced by AI. Mark, could you help us understand what AI is or isn't, and how it's affecting our lives both now and in the future?
Well, it certainly comes in many different forms, and I think people are not necessarily aware of the most simple forms of AI that they're engaging with on a regular basis. One of the most basic forms it can come in is the form of a recommendation engine. So that might be something like Google, auto-completing a search result for you, for example, because by the first word you put in, they know the next three words that you're most likely to enter into that field. That could be an AI algorithm that's determined, that search term by looking at, data, and data is kind of the fuel that is used in the engine of AI. So that's just a small example, but you go to also on YouTube, for example, if you're watching a video and they want to serve you the next video that you're most likely to continue watching, that would be an algorithm built on AI as well.
A lot of people, as Amy mentioned, when they think about AI, they think about it fearfully. They think about robots taking their jobs and AI taking over humanity and so forth. Mark, what are people getting wrong about AI?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword. I think that some skepticism is certainly healthy, but when used for good, it's an incredibly, incredibly powerful tool. The other thing I would say to those who are particularly fearful is acceptance is important because it is part of our future. So I think rather than being purely fearful of it, it would be wiser to perhaps try and gain a better understanding of it because that way we can hopefully help shape the ways in which it's used in the future and make sure that, it's used for good and not evil, let's say.
Amy, you refer to AI as the third era of computing. Can you explain what you mean by this?
The very first computers as we know them today were conceptualized in the 1800s, the mid-1800s. The very first era of computing was tabulation-based, so these were mechanical devices that made simple tabulations. And as we had more components, more power, more ability over the decades into the 1950s and 60s, there was a transition from simple machines to more complex machines able to do challenging computations and even things like break encryption. So in the World War II era going forward, we entered into the era of programmable systems. So, and some people may be old enough to remember computers that didn't have all of the components on the inside of the CPU that were necessary to run systems. I mean, as a kid, I had to put floppy disks into my computer to make it work. The big floppy disks, mm-hmm. not the small floppy disks. So that was still a system running, maybe powerful, but still fairly simplistic programs. Today, we're in this new era of computing that is more cognitive oriented. So rather than a system running commands predetermined by a human, we are asking systems to use data to make more decisions and increasingly even choices autonomously. And to some extent, that is to just develop shortcuts, as Mark explained, to help us out in everyday life, like tell us which video to watch next, or to make the anti-lock brakes on our cars work, or to figure out the fastest route to get from point A to point B using a GPS. But the real promise of these systems is to fill in for some of the limitations that we have as humans. So if we're able to add a very powerful cognitive machine into the mix that might look at patterns differently because it's literally wired differently, the promise here is that we get to cures for cancer that we just literally had never thought of before, or that we're able to perform computations very, very quickly at scale to rapidly prototype and test not a few ideas, but potentially millions of different ideas and combinations to help us get to the right design constraints or whatever it might be if we're thinking about building a better car or a new kind of rocket ship.
Amy, you always write something very profound. And one thing that struck me interesting was that you say that we are in the midst of significant transformation, not unlike the generation who lived through the Industrial Revolution. Quite interesting. What is transforming and how does it actually compare with the Industrial Revolution?
I think a lot of people look at this new age of automation as analogous to the transition that humanity went through during the Industrial Revolution, and there are certainly some similarities. The way that we move about our daily lives is different now and will continue to be as we go through this transition. The way that we operate and do business, so there are certainly areas that are analogous. I think those similarities end when we start thinking about the implications. So the Industrial Revolution was about machines that automated tasks for us. You know, that helped spur growth in different industrial sectors and business sectors. It increased productivity. It also led to people being out of work. But those were not cognitive tasks. And the era that we are going through now is not just about repetition, but also cognition. Now, the interesting thing here is that the speculation around the world is that all of this automation will lead to blue-collar workers facing great waves of unemployment. So truck drivers, you know, people in, let's say, areas that are doing analysis that require a lot of reading and looking for keywords. I mean, that's the kind of thing that a machine learning system can do. The interesting thing, however, is that, as it turns out, biology and evolution in humans has culminated in us being pretty good machines ourselves. You know, we are pretty energy efficient when we are moving our arms and legs to do things. And as it turns out, you know, at the moment, robots aren't truly able to replicate us in a cost-effective way at scale. However, the cognitive tasks have proven to be, in some cases, better done by robots. So, you know, we've started to see situations where there are warehouses, and rather than robots taking over the human labor jobs, it's humans performing the robotic jobs and the machines doing more of the cognitive tasks to optimize workflows and pathways and all the like, all the rest of it.
Mark, let me ask you this. Technology is advancing at such an incredibly rapid rate. And while that's fine, there's a factor that must be considered, and that's humans' reaction to technology. A number of humans, are quite resistant to it. And when I think about that, I'm thinking about self-driving cars. And there aren't very many people that I know that are comfortable with that concept. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, to kind of segue from what Amy was just talking about with the Industrial Revolution, you know, there was a school called the Luddites at that time in England, which was basically a group of workers that would kind of destroy or sabotage machinery that they thought was threatening their livelihoods, that was going to take their jobs. And I think that sentiment, while it's obviously a very different context today, that sentiment remains, that there is quite a bit of fear around these new technologies today, whether it's because they might take our jobs or whether because they might take over in areas where we don't necessarily have trust for machines. So with autonomous driving, it's definitely an interesting area in which this sort of phenomenon plays out. And what you see is that, you know, there have been a couple of accidents and, you know, at least one major instance of a death caused by a car that was using autonomous driving at the time. And there's great outrage about this because I think there's a lot of questions in people's minds as to who is responsible when a car that is driving itself ends up, you know, killing a person on the road. But when you step back and look at, you know, potential statistics around autonomous driving versus human driving, the potential to lower the amount of errors and accidents that result in human death is great. And so while we are very skeptical at first of, you know, handing over the wheel, so to speak, to computers, I think we need to take a look now at how many accidents and deaths are caused on the road by human error. And statistically, it looks, you know, quite probable that we would be able to reduce those by implementing autonomous driving systems, as long as the proper safety precautions are put in place.
I'll just add that when we think about the future of technology, we tend to get stuck on things like robots and autonomous cars and artificial intelligence. In our annual report from 2018 or 2019 on tech trends, and as we're preparing our 2020 report, you know, we're looking at hundreds of different emerging trends and technology. And I think it would be super useful as people are thinking about the year ahead and the decade ahead to really, you know, obviously keep AI as part of that focal area. But we have so many other really interesting technologies that we're reviewing and areas of research. I think it would be terrific for people to broaden their horizon just a little bit.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I am Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. My guest is Amy Webb and Mark Palatucci of the Future Today Institute, a leading future forecasting firm. Amy is the Institute's founder and CEO, and Mark is a futurist with the company. Amy is also the author of several books, including her latest, The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity, which warns of the dangers of nine of the world's biggest tech companies. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. I'd also like to tell you that a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You can find them at the Google Play Store for Android or Apple's App Store for their devices. We also hope you'll get in touch with us through either Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. Now, back to today's Press Conference USA with Amy Webb and Mark Palatucci of the Future Today Institute, a leading future forecasting company. Mark, can you give us a little sample of some of the other technologies that you're looking at that is going to shape the world in the next 5 to 10 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we're most excited about here is the dawn of smart glasses. It looks like in the next year or two, we're going to see a lot of movement in that space. And of course, a lot of people, when they hear smart glasses, think back to Google Glass and sort of the failures of that product launch. But, you know, that was over 5 years ago now. And a lot of these companies have been working hard to sort of develop that technology further, correct some of the mistakes that were made back then with that launch. That was a bit of a false start, let's say. But in the next couple of years, we're going to see a number of the big tech companies launch smart glasses, which we feel is sort of coming about. That trend is coming about in parallel with the relative fading or the beginning of the obsolescence of the smartphone as the primary personal device. So the smartphone has certainly served us well for quite a while, but it has one design flaw that is kind of irreconcilable with the human body, which is that we need to carry it in our hands. And, you know, you talked about sort of technology evolving so much faster than humans. And I think there is an effort to sort of, you know, we're constantly trying to catch up and constantly trying to adapt technology to our bodies, which obviously take a much longer time to evolve. And one way to do so is to kind of change the format of that technology. So if we're able to take the functionality of a smartphone and sort of transpose it to a set of smart eyewear that can sit on our face and not occupy our hands, it frees us up to do quite a bit more, not to mention the things it enables that smartphones don't enable. You may have seen some of these head-mounted displays that involve slotting an iPhone or a similar smartphone into a device that is then mounted on the face. Well, if we were able to have a set of glasses that could do this in the first place, we wouldn't need all that kind of complicated hardware to do so. And another tech trend that will continue in the next few years and definitely proliferate in the next 5 to 10 is the rise of augmented reality and virtual reality, which will obviously be greatly enabled by this smart glasses technology, where we may be able to, you know, have these glasses on our face and experience augmented reality or virtual reality pretty seamlessly without having to set up a new device or change our environment, change what we're wearing and using to do so. Another interesting kind of area in which AR has already become quite popular is in workplace training. We think about AR as potentially being just entertainment-based. A lot of us kind of go first into that entertainment area when we think about something like virtual reality, augmented reality. But it's actually quite useful, let's say, on the factory floor to help train a worker by giving a virtual overlay on what they're looking at to help them figure out a new process, for example.
You know, Mark, you were talking about using virtual reality, augmented reality in the workplace, and I'm thinking that this concept has been around for a long, long time. Like, for example, the airline industry and even the spaceflight industry use simulators.
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider that virtual reality?
That is sort of simulated reality, for sure. But actually, and it's interesting you bring up the airline industry. They're using something called, they're developing this technology and evolving this technology called the digital twin, which is basically creating a digital facsimile that is a perfect representation or as perfect a representation as possible of let's say, an aircraft. And so an engineer is able to kind of analyze the inner workings of that aircraft without having to send somebody physically into the fuselage and into the engine, et cetera. And they can monitor what's going on that aircraft in a virtual setting. And that can be enhanced again with AR and VR and allow them to basically operate a lot more efficiently.
Amy, one of the other key takeaways from your 2019 report dealt with privacy, that privacy is dead. Amy, what do you mean privacy is dead? Is it unreasonable now for us to expect to have privacy while we're online?
Right. So, and this will be something that we continue to address in 2020. One of our key findings in our 2019 report was that, you know, anybody alive today is most likely going to be using some kind of digital infrastructure and tool, whether that's email or some kind of mobile phone or computer. But quite frankly, in most places all around the world, mobile devices have leapfrogged all other types of computers, which means that we are continuously generating data, and the companies that own and make the products that we use are in the business of mining, refining, and productizing that data for a wide variety of purposes, either to authenticate us or to nudge us or to grant or deny us permissions or to monetize that data in some way, which means that, you know, in the year 2019 and 2020 and beyond, we really should have no expectation that all of our data all of the time and basically everything that we're doing all of the time is private. Even in places like the European Union, which have much more restrictive policies around data usage, the fact of the matter is we're all being recorded. There are cameras everywhere. There are devices everywhere.
One thing I'd add as well is that this can happen on a very small scale. So just to give an example, say you are somebody who preferred to use cash rather than go with a bank and sign up for a bank account. I've seen just in New York City in the last couple of years, quite a few establishments go from accepting cash and cards to being card only, to being cash free. And that's sort of this instance in which you have no choice, where if you want to even go buy a sandwich, you're going to need a bank account. That bank account and that bank is going to track how much you're spending, where you're spending it, and that's the sort of data that's being collected by these organizations to be used and, as Amy said, to be refined and productized. And so that's just a very small example where it sort of becomes unavoidable to give up your data in certain circumstances.
Well, it's a small example that ties into a bigger example and bigger trend for 2020, which is that all of the big tech companies are now also getting into financial services. So in the past year, you know, Apple has launched a credit card that with its partner Goldman Sachs that doesn't follow the typical business model of a credit card product that might be available elsewhere. So they're not making the majority of their money on late payments and interest. They're making money in other ways. Google is launching a checking account service in the United States. Amazon is in the financial payment system. You know, financial services is a thorny, difficult market to get into anywhere in the world, in part because the regulatory infrastructure is rough, but also because this is an area dominated by players who have already been in this space now for many, many decades. So you have to stop and ask yourself, with all of its successes, why would Amazon bother getting into this? Why would they bother with payments? Why on earth would Apple launch a credit card? Why would Google bother with checking accounts? The simple answer here is because data that they are able to collect as part of that transaction is more valuable than the monetary value of the transaction itself.
One of the trends that you point out is called the ascension of China. Tell us about how China is going to play a role in everything we see regarding technology and influence in the future.
Sure. Well, you know, for the past, I don't know, decade or so, we've started to see some fundamental shifts in the Chinese government and its relationship with the rest of the world. So, you know, President Xi Jinping, I think, is very, very smart and has done a very good job aligning the Chinese Communist Party to send middle managers and diplomats and people all around the world. So they've done a really good job of developing key relationships in the usual places, but also in areas, you know, throughout Africa and Southeast Asia, where maybe there hasn't been so much of a foreign presence previously. In addition to doing that, there are some top-level state initiatives like the Belt and Road Initiative and the 10,000 Talents Plan, which have endeavored to help spread China's influence. at least from a trade perspective and talent perspective. However, that ties in with a lot of the fundamental technologies that are being researched and developed in China. And while all that's been happening, there's a lot domestically that's starting to change too. So as of December 1st, 2019, anybody in China who wants a mobile device has to scan their face and submit it to a national registry. You know, and in addition to the fact that there are these, you know, there's cameras everywhere, and not just typical CCTV cameras, you know, China's in the process of developing these 500 megapixel, very, very powerful cameras with computer vision technologies baked into them so that in a stadium, you know, a camera can catch a fourth of somebody, a half of somebody's face, you know, if they're turned to the side, and recognize who they are.
Can you give us a little overview, a little picture, if you can, of the future, especially what's coming up in the year 2020 as far as technology trends and other trends we should be really paying attention to?
What I would say is there's a tremendous amount of really interesting emerging technologies on the horizon, and the best possible thing for everybody to do is to pay attention as broadly as they possibly can. But my colleague, Mark, has even more detail that I think he'd love to share.
We already touched on glasses as a major technology that's going to, smart glasses as a major technology that's really going to come to the forefront in the next couple of years. Along with that, we're also going to see big developments in the sort of devices like an Amazon Alexa, Google Home, those sorts of things have been obviously providing services to everybody and kind of enabling the beginnings of the smart home, which is also, you know, another kind of element of the future that we're going to see developing in the next few years. But they've also been helping perfect and improve the voice technology that's going to be critical for something like a smart glasses, all the technology that we're going to be using that will be hands-free. Hands-free is definitely a term you're going to hear a lot more in the future. In terms of social media, I think we're going to see a ton more scrutiny. We've seen a lot recently in terms of, even as recently as this last few months, looking at a social media platform like TikTok. And, you know, that is a company that is Chinese-based. And the U.S. has become very skeptical as to how that platform is being used and what data might be gleaned from that platform by China, even if it's American users and potentially used against us or used as a tool for digital espionage. We've also seen Twitter announce that they're taking political ads off the platform entirely, whereas Facebook has seemed to double down in certain ways on political advertising. And we just saw, you know, an election in the UK, and it was a pretty big landslide for the conservative candidate. And there is good evidence that Facebook played a decent role in helping to get that candidate elected. So we're going to see a lot more scrutiny from the average user who is potentially maybe getting a little bit more skeptical about the ways in which social media can be used. The only other thing I'd say is that in addition to all the big tech companies getting into the banking and finance industry, they're also moving very heavily into medicine. And we're going to see that play out and come out in many more ways in the next few years that are going to affect the end consumer. So as these companies, you know, develop systems to potentially offer health insurance, let's say, they're also going to be using their devices to basically incorporating their devices into that healthcare ecosystem. So you might see a future in which you could be speaking to a digital home assistant made by one of these companies and potentially telling them your symptoms or, you know, almost self-diagnosing with their help at home. And then that very same company that makes that device might be providing you with a prescription or connecting you to a doctor. And of course, collecting all of that data and incorporating it into your health insurance as well.
Amy Webb and Mark Palatucci from the Future Today Institute. I want to thank you both for taking time to talk with us today and for giving us a little peek into the future as far as technology.
It's one of our very favorite things we do every year. So thanks for having us back.
That was Amy Webb, author, futurist, and founder of the Future Today Institute, and futurist Mark Palatucci. Amy's latest book is called The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and their thinking machines could warp humanity. And it's available from your favorite online bookseller. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this edition of Press Conference USA. Press Conference USA was recorded and produced at the Voice of America Broadcast Center in Washington. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.